I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Antonio Lopez. He is a media literacy expert. He teaches media literacy in Rome, Italy. He's former writer for the Santa Fe New Mexican, and he's author of the new book, The Media Ecosystem, What Ecology Can Teach Us About Responsible Media Practice. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, using an ecosystem metaphor for the media, what's that all about? Explain it in kind of the large sense of both ecosystem and then the whole sphere of the media.
What I'm trying to do with this book is to actually repurpose the term ecosystem, because it's, in my opinion, being abused pretty heavily when people talk about computers, Facebook, iPhone, for example. Let's say the Apple ecosystem, the Facebook ecosystem, the Google.
Do they use that?
Yes, that's a commonly used term. And ecosystem is an appropriate metaphor in the sense that it's about a system, whereas the traditional media was more top-down, and so it was more of an industrial model of media. So new media has a more horizontal networked character to it. So the term ecosystem is being appropriated, but it's a very incomplete term, because the actual ecosystem of media has a huge impact on the environment, which is, they're in denial about this. So, for example, Apple could have, at various different stages in the development of their computers, had an environmental position, and it wasn't until activists came in from the outside and started criticizing them and say, no, these computers are actually very toxic, and you can't recycle them. I mean, now they have a take back program, but they've been heavily criticized for developing computers that you can't open, you can't fix them, you can't upgrade them, you can't buy new batteries. You just have to, you know, toss them essentially. And then there's the other aspect of social justice, in that the entire production and supply chain of computer manufacturing has a long trail of not only toxic impact on the environment, but also a very negative impact on the people that are making the computers, who are processing the minerals, that where there's very rare metals used, earth metals in computers, and they often come from areas in Africa,
like the Congo, where people are getting raped and killed. And
exactly, and in fact, I have an anecdote in the book where I talk about several years ago when the PlayStation 2 came out. There was they knew that there was going to be such high sales for the device that Sony was going to release that it led to a land rush for those particular minerals in the Congo, which happened to be in preserves. And the PlayStation actually led to the impact on the gorilla population in the jungle from like 17,000 to like 7,000. Because the mines that were used to extract the metals for the PlayStation, there was also a lot of market speculation, so that it became worth a lot of money, that particular mineral, because it was going to be used for making all these devices.
So that these are all things that really nobody knows about. They think that they're buying things in isolation from the actual ecosystem that we're living in, which is part of the point of your book.
Right, exactly. So and this is a legacy of Western thinking, which is that media is seen to be as something that has to do with mental activities, so it's not something that is physical. And so it's somehow disembedded from the environment, that it's not connected to not only the physical aspects of the environment, but also one of the other points I make in the book is that media impact the way we perceive the environment. So how we define nature is, one way that happens is we're educated through advertising. Like, what is the purpose of nature? It's for economic growth. It's for consumption. It's for extraction of resources. And we just get indoctrinated into that system through marketing. So we buy into, when I say we, I mean, you know, like the royal we. Obviously, a lot of the listeners here get this. But in general, people don't talk about the media in terms of the impact on how we perceive the environment.
Well, there's another part, which is we perceive nature as picturesque.
Right.
And sort of out there, a kind of almost a framed picture that we take pictures of and stuff like that, but not really quite being our sustenance and that which we need in order to breathe and survive and things like that.
Yeah, a very good example of that would be car advertising. And one of the criticisms that people who are in the field of environmental communications, who study how marketing impacts or how media impacts our perception of the environment is when you look at, like, let's say SUV ads, what you see is that cities are where people live and nature is where you go to, like, on vacation. You don't work in nature. Nature is pristine. It's like somehow isolated from our daily lives. And the only way to get to that point is you have to drive your spaceship, you know, take the SUV from you know, civilization to the wild, but you're right. Protected by this shell, this technological shell.
Now, you said a moment ago that all this has to do with Western thinking. What did you mean by that?
Well, the term ecology itself, if you go back to the origins of it, was coined in the 1800s. And originally, the root is Greek. It comes from oikos, which means household, which is also what the term economics comes from. So the original concept of ecology is related to also economics, that those two ideas originally were embedded. So when you talked about the environment, you're also talking about management of the household. You know, how do you manage how you survive, how you live? And at a certain point in Western thinking, as a result of the Enlightenment, but also just academic disciplines, et cetera, or also the ideology of technological progress, the idea of the physical realm and the mental realm separated. And so even if you look at a university catalog, almost all the ecology courses are science courses. You know, they don't have humanities courses about the environment. I mean, there's a few here and there, but it's very rare.
Like the poetry of certain environmental poets and writers.
Right, exactly. So I had a struggle I teach undergraduate media courses in Rome at a university. It was a struggle for me to get the administration to acknowledge that I could do a media and environment class, that those two topics were related. And because if you come from a traditional academic background, you would just look at that idea and say, that's absurd. You know, how could you equate media with the environment? And that has infiltrated our general thinking. So when you see a lot of the utopian thinkers about technology, they never talk about technology relationship to the environment. They talk about it in terms of progress, about how it's a sign of our civilization advancing forward. But they don't talk about how technology also has a very deep impact on our living systems. And so we're now at an interesting point where I'm sure most everyone understands, at least the listeners of this program, that we're facing an ecological catastrophe on a planetary scale if we don't address this problem.
Most notably, but not limited to, climate change.
Yes, climate change being the main driver, which everyone is feeling this summer, this very hot summer. And in my own community of practitioners, of media literacy educators and media scholars, etc., it's been a real struggle to get them to recognize that this is an issue that's relevant to media. They just see that as, it's like, oh, that's someone else's problem, that someone else should teach that subject, or someone else should write about that. So by writing the book, The Media Ecosystem, I was trying to really bring the eco back into ecosystem. And it'll be controversial, at least in the community of practitioners that I'm coming from, and I'm waiting to get a response because it's only been out for 10 days. But I suspect that I'm going to encounter some hostility, whereas others might say, well, thank God, you know, finally we're talking about this. And
well, I mean, everything that we do, if you think about it for a minute or two, has an environmental impact. I mean, I'm using an Apple computer right now to record this show. We're using a mixing board. We're drinking things at the cafe that come across the ocean on coffee barges. I mean, every single thing we do has an impact. And I think, on the one hand, it's really important to have an awareness of those things. But on the other hand, it's really hard, A, not to get overwhelmed and then just throw the whole thing out and say, well, it's bigger than I am. And B, to really start to figure out how to make good choices, because it's almost like you got to live in a cave.
Right.
And grow your own organic mushrooms or whatever if you don't want to be part of that in a pretty big way, even as we're all sitting here being so nicely conscious.
Yeah, I had to grapple with that particular contradiction because, so on the one hand, I'm saying let's be responsible about our media practices, whether it's what we consume or the kinds of messages that we're putting out there, or, you know, what are we even talking about or covering in the media? And
what are we covering? What are they covering?
Yeah.
I mean, you and I mean, we're sitting here doing a local radio show, but what they're covering in the really big mainstream media is very different.
Right. And that's one of the points I make, is that the corporate media are a big problem, because they're embedded with the financial system that's embedded with the energy companies. I mean, GE, which is a majority owner, well, actually, Comcast is now the majority owner of NBC Universal, but General Electric, you know, makes nuclear weapons. And so how is the major multinational media company going to be objective when it comes to environmental issues? So corporate media are a huge problem, and I talk about that in the book. That's also one of the reasons why I talk about Occupy. And at the time that I was writing this book was during the peak of the Occupy movement in the U.S. It was last fall. And
has it passed its peak?
Well, maybe it remains to be seen what happens. But I mean, sort of peak attention. The attention span of the media is very short.
Right.
And I imagine that it'll flare up in different ways. The way I think of it is like kind of like a rhizome. It dies down one place, it goes up like in Canada, and then it goes up in Mexico, and then it'll come back in California. You know, so it just goes in waves.
Right.
And hopefully those waves will increase. But one of the points I wanted to make was the argument of Occupy movement, which I failed to be lacking in a particular ecological critique. It was there. Their focus more on financial institutions and the corruption of democracy. I would have liked to have seen more discussion of ecological issues, but at the same time, I felt like their essential position of the 99% versus 1% also translates to the media. I mean, we have the 1% media, which is, you know, the five dominant corporations in the U.S., which essentially dominate entertainment and news and, you know, even the internet at this point.
And are opinion makers for the 99% of people.
Yeah, exactly. And it follows the classic line of hegemony where you're only allowed to talk about certain things, not talk about other things. So I noticed, for example, I teach in a international classroom. I have Italian and European students. I have American students. Americans are the least informed about climate change. It doesn't even exist, whereas the Europeans are very much on their radar. They're talking about it. They don't doubt it. They don't question it. Whereas the Americans, it's a real struggle to get this topic into their attention.
We're talking to Antonio Lopez about his book, The Media Ecosystem. So that is a problem, as we've discussed, and as many, many people have discussed on radio stations like this one, of basically huge amounts of money being put into PR by the fossil fuel industry that questions the science of climate change and all that. And we know this, but how do you educate Americans?
It's difficult, but I think this is why I talk about Occupy. Occupy was also an educational process. So people who got exposed to it learned new things, and they went down to the Occupy sites, and they were exposed to new forms of democracy. And so one of the things I talk about is that the form of the media is very important in terms of, like the Gandhi saying that people always say, you know, be the change that you want to see in the world. If you support alternative media, community media, like this station, you are, in a sense, helping promote a change in the media ecosystem, because every time that you're putting your attention and your money, if you're donating, for example, towards community public radio, you're taking something away from the corporate media. So supporting community media is absolutely important. Media literacy is essential. New Mexico is really in a good position compared to most states in the U.S. as far as having media literacy as part of a curriculum, you know, in regular schools.
Is that right?
Yeah, because New Mexico has been in the forefront of promoting media literacy as a part of educational policy. So you'll see more of it here than you'll see in other places.
Now, you say in your book somewhere that the media could really be thought of at its best as a kind of immune system for the for society. And I often think of media literacy as an inoculation. In other words, once I see through the ways in which, for example, advertisements are trying to sway what I do, or once I learn about, for example, what's in certain products that they're trying to sell me, there's nothing they can do to sell me those products. They can stand on their head, they can drag me kicking and screaming, they can make it sound like I will be rich and happy if I buy it, but it's not going to work because I've had enough training to see through it.
Right. Media literacy is mental self-defense.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, I like to use the term mindfulness, you know, for Buddhism, because when you understand how your thinking process works, in a way you become inoculated from it. It doesn't take control over you. And like you say, once you understand how the media manipulates, you know, what are the different tactics that are used, you're able to see through it. It's kind of like that John Carpenter movie, I don't know if you ever saw it, They Live, where they have these special sunglasses, and once you put on the sunglasses, you can see who the aliens were. And you can see all the ads were subliminal propaganda statements,
right.
You know. It's kind of like getting those magic glasses.
Right.
And it does take the power out of the sales. And in fact, I would say the best compliment I've ever gotten from parents of my students is to say that I've ruined TV watching in their house, because, you know, now the kids, all they do is talk about and critically engage what they're seeing, and the parents don't like it. And it's hard for people to watch media with me, because I'm like that too, and I'm a running commentary, and I think it's kind of annoying to people.
It's no coincidence that in the state of Texas, I think it was part of the Republican platform, I don't know if they took it out or not, that stood up against critical thinking in education. Like, they wanted to strike critical thinking from the curricula of the school system in Texas.
Yeah, that's... You know, actually, the fact is that they've already done that in general education policy anyways, but for them to sort of openly say that just shows how far we've gone in terms of going backwards in education. So all the problems I talk about in the book are connected to other problems. You know, it's not... I'm just trying to think holistically about the media, but whatever I say about the media could be applied to economic situation, to education, to health. I mean, they're all closely related.
How did you come to write this book? Does it arise from your media literacy teaching?
Basically, what happened was this book is a part of a series of manifestos that's being published by the Evolver community. And Evolver is an online social network. They're kind of like, I call them new edgers, you know, kind of Burning Man types. They're sort of quasi-spiritual, political, artistic-oriented type people. And they have a website called Reality Sandwich, which is an online magazine. And I did some media criticism for that. And one of the movers and shakers of that community is named Daniel Pinchbeck. And so he actually contacted me. He said, "We want you to write our media book." So they're doing a series of books now. This is, I think, the fourth one. And but originally, it wasn't going to be about ecology in particular. I mean, that's always in the background of anything I do. That's my interest. The original idea of the book was decolonize the media. Now, because when I teach media, I think about media as sort of a colonization of our minds, of our habits, of our being. So I initially wrote it from that perspective. And I had a particular person in mind when I was writing. I don't know if you know the Bonnaroo Music Festival in Tennessee. Well, a few years ago, I went there to work on a documentary about their recycling, because they're very good about recycling. And music festivals are actually talk about environmentally destructive media.
Right.
You know, music festivals are horribly destructive. Anyone who's gone to Coachella can remark on the sea of plastic bottles that you have to walk over. But anyways, one evening I was in the food court just eating by myself, and a young man sat down at the table. He was college-aged. I think he was from Alabama, somewhere in the South. He was a nice kid, so he was asking me, what do I do? And so I told him I was interested. I was a media educator. And about 15 minutes into the discussion, I was deconstructing the entire marketing background of what was present at the festival, you know, the branding, the demographics, and I was talking about how he was profiled by corporations, and I was basically deconstructing his reality. And I think I could see that he was getting blown away.
Like upset or happy or?
No, disturbed.
Yeah.
And he didn't use this term, but I think he said something to the effect of, like, are you some kind of wizard? I was like, no, I'm just educated. You know, I understand how the system works. And he was, I think flabbergasted might be the right term. He had no idea. He was clearly curious, but he just didn't know how the system works. And
so you wrote this for him?
In a sense, yeah. I wanted, but that was my initial track. You know, he was at college age. And so when I originally approached this book, I was writing sort of on the level of like a young person who would be entering into the world, and how should they think about the media and their place in the world. And then I got feedback from the manuscript, and they said, well, let's change the focus to write something more for professionals, people who work in the media, who actually have some background, who are a little more educated. So I had to ramp up the language a little bit and change the focus. So I think the underlying current remains that I have this sort of young person in mind who is not educated about how this whole process works. But then I sort of transformed that to focus more on the idea of ecosystems, because this is the sort of the buzzword that I see going around with new media, and I wanted to critique that. And also me being an ecologist, that sort of allowed me to, I had more freedom to just throw that in there. Because at first, it goes to show the level of disconnection. When I first approached the book, I didn't feel comfortable saying, okay, this is going to be a book about media and ecology. But as I got more into it, I just went for it. How people respond to it remains to be seen, if they'll actually get what I'm saying.
We're talking to Antonio Lopez about his book, The Media Ecosystem, What Ecology Can Teach Us About Responsible Media Practice. I think you kind of hit on the crux of the problem a moment ago when you were talking about how when Sony made the PlayStation 2, it resulted in a dramatic drop in the number of guerrillas, because the materials that they needed to make this thing were found in a nature preserve. So what I am having a hard time envisioning is a world in which, on the one hand, people have the stuff that they want and need, and on the other hand, there would be a world in which a company would either not be allowed to or make the decision not to do ecological harmful practices.
Yeah, that's the problem, because, you know, should I stop buying Apple because I disagree with their approach? On the other hand, it's a very powerful communication device that allows me to promote at least the work that I think needs to be promoted.
And it's way better than the alternative.
Exactly. And so, you know, one of the things is that I realized that sustainable practices also need to be attractive in the sense that they need to be good solutions. And we're in a transition. I think what we have to do is think about ourselves is we're not at the solution stage yet. We're sort of at the beginning of a transition into better technology. We need to put pressure on companies like, you know, Greenpeace put a lot of pressure on Apple to not use mountaintop removal as their source coal for their server farms, and they were successful. Apple has responded a lot to people's complaints about their other environmental practices. They have a long ways to go. I mean, Steve Jobs, as much as people loved him, he was on the environmental issue just absolutely awful. And also not to mention social justice in terms of the treatment of workers. And they still have a long ways to go. But should we just completely disengage these technologies? And if we do that, in a sense, what may happen is nothing will change, because we won't have a way to communicate with the system. So one of the things I advocate is come in contact with the system, and the places you come into contact with the system, engage it in a mindful way, in an active way.
What does that look like?
Well, for example, you could participate and support organizations that are putting pressure on technology companies. You could help educate other people. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Stuff, which is an online web project where they do these little animations where they educate people. And they have a whole one about creating technology. And one of the issues they talk about is we need better laws that demand that if the company makes a product, that they have to take it back.
Right.
So like Apple, in Europe, this is actually is in place. So if something's manufactured in Europe, the manufacturer has to take it back at the end of the life of the product. And they're responsible for recycling, et cetera. And one of the points that is made is that if the onus is on the company, not the consumer, the company will design better products.
Right.
So there's laws, there's consumer activism.
And those laws, getting laws like that passed, depends or would depend on having a system which is not totally bought and paid for by corporations in the first place.
Exactly. So that's how this relates to Occupy. So if you have a corporate-dominated political system, it's going to impact the environment no matter what. So these are all interrelated. So decisions like Citizens United may not directly be related to the issue of the media ecosystem, but on the other hand, it allows corporations to dominate the media space in the public sphere and to push aside the important issues and to influence how we talk about climate change, etc. So in a sense, they are very closely related.
You talk about something that you call, and I love this idea, what is it, a media farmer's market or media slow food?
Yeah, so...
Or slow media?
Yeah, slow media. Well, so there's two parts to this. One is I stole the idea from Bill McKibben, who wrote in his book Deep Economy, he said the sonic equivalent of a farmer's market. And radio is a very good example of something that's constricted by geology and by nature, because the radio tower can only reach a certain space. It's shaped by mountains.
Unless you're listening to internet radio.
Yeah, or internet or satellite.
Yeah.
But traditional FM or AM radio is limited by physical space. But also, he makes the point that they did a study that you're more likely to have a conversation in a farmer's market than you are in a supermarket. And so he said, you know, if we have media that creates conversations, that's better than sort of the McDonald's type of media, which creates no conversation, which sort of dictates how you should think about things. There's top-down, like Fox News or MSNBC, things like that. Whereas local radio, like you and I are having a discussion, you're not going to get this kind of discussion on mainstream media because...
It's too long.
Yeah, yeah. You have to think about it. You have to slow down. So
yeah.
This is an example of slow media. And then slow media also is something that I was inspired by slow food in Italy, where I live. Slow food is about don't look at food as something that's a matter of convenience, but as a ritual. You know, get the food that's fresh, have a long, drawn-out meal, cook it, sit down with people, have a conversation, drink wine, or whatever it is you do, and have a long... This is how people eat in Italy. It's inspiring. People don't eat in cars. They don't walk around with coffee cups, you know. You go to the bar, you have a conversation with the barista, and you slow down. And so, for me, examples of slow media are like poetry slams. I mean, I know poetry slams sort of have a quick pace.
Yeah.
But... You know, it's live. It's organic. It's like the texture of organic vegetables versus industrial farm vegetables. It has more richness. It has more subtlety. I like this idea of living room screenings. You know, a lot of independent filmmakers now don't do movie theaters. They don't do TV. You can get a DVD from them directly. You organize. They give you the tools through the internet how to set up a screening at your house. Your friends come over, or you invite people, your family, you watch the film, you discuss it. And for me, that's a much richer experience than the much faster ways that people consume media. Cell phones, iPads, you know, we sort of cram it in whatever we have free time.
And there's also an awareness that is in that. I mean, if you're watching a screening in your living room, you're probably aware of all kinds of things like the ambient noise and the size of the screen and things like that. Whereas when you're watching a movie on your cell phone, you're not really watching it, because there's a lot that's built into a movie that was meant to be seen on the, at very least, a sizable TV, if not a big silver screen in a theater. And you're literally not seeing it, and you're not aware that you're not seeing it. I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah, and one of the things I talk about in the book is So far I've talked about two impacts of media on the environment. There's the physical impact of the actual material extraction and the waste. I've talked about how the mind print of how media influence the way we think about nature. But there's another dimension, which is space, place, and time. And increasingly, people are getting lost in their devices. And I see this with my students, because I work with college-age students. I'll walk down the street. I work in a neighborhood that has a lot of young people. I'll walk by a table. There'll be five people at this table drinking beer, each one on their own little smartphone.
No.
Away, you know.
Talking with somebody who isn't at the table?
Yeah, and they're not talking to each other.
Yeah.
And so people are losing a sense of embeddedness in their own environments. They're losing the habitat of their living world. In these, I'm not against cyberspace. I love cyberspace. Let's go there. Let's have fun. But let's not spend. We need to moderate that so that we're not just so projected out into outside of our immediate environment that we lose sight of where we are. So one of the assignments I do with my students is that, and they hate this assignment, they have to get lost in Rome, and they cannot take any media devices with them.
Right.
And no maps, no notebooks, no pencils, nothing.
How do you get them lost?
Well, I just, walk out the door, because they will get lost because they're so attached to their navigation devices. And I'm nice to them. I say you could do it for 2 hours. I would like to have them do it for a day, but I know they wouldn't do it. So I have to manage how much time they will take away from their devices. And then they have to reflect on it, write about it. We talk about it in class. And, there's a handful of students who absolutely it's torture for them. And they keep touching their pocket. They want, where's that phone? They want that. They're afraid that someone might want to talk to them. And they don't want to be disconnected. Then there's a group of people who just absolutely love it. They're like, I smelled for the first time.
Yeah.
Or, I wish I had done this assignment 2 years ago. I would have seen the city for the first, now I can see the city.
Have you done it yourself?
Oh, yeah. I impose, I make restrictions just as a matter of practice. And that's part of my, kind of like people have like a mindfulness practice, meditation. Well, part of my mindfulness practice is not using the internet. I don't have a phone connected to the internet. I try to limit my time in media. And I try also even with listening to music. So sometimes I walk through an amazing city that's 3,000 years old. I walk from work. I get off the bus. I drive by the Colosseum, all these amazing places. And if I'm listening to music, and sometimes I need to do that. I need to sort of inoculate myself and drug myself, so to speak. There's a time and a place for that. But other times, I force myself to experience all the sounds of the city. In fact, I don't want to lose that. And sometimes I see bicyclists with their headphones on, and I worry about them because they can't hear cars, they can't hear. And how can they do that? I feel like you need to be able to hear and see everything.
I saw a man the other day, young man, walking across a busy street, smoking a cigarette and talking on a cell phone. I was like, wow, he's killing himself in three ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
All at once.
Yeah, there's actually documented cases of people getting killed because they walk into a street and they're not watching traffic because they're... So this is what I mean by people sort of losing their sense of place, time, and space to internet or to their devices. And I don't really have faith that people have the ability to moderate themselves. I mean, it takes real discipline.
Yeah.
So people really have to go to mindfulness training to be able to stop it. In the same way that people have to, if they have an addiction, they have to really pay attention to what are the triggers for the addiction. But I think educators could do a better job of doing these kind of activities, because I think it's not going to work for everybody, but a few people will have that experience and go, wow, there really is a difference. Like sometimes in my class, I'll have students sit silently for 5 minutes, and I don't tell them what they're supposed to do. I just say, you have to put everything away, close your eyes, and I'll tell you when you can stop. And I can tell that they're squirming. It's like, it's just 5 minutes. And then I say, okay, now, and then I show them a 5-minute James Bond clip on YouTube. I say, compare those two experiences. How fast they went. They're both 5 minutes, but which one went faster?
Right. And obviously, the sitting with your eyes closed goes much more slowly and is much more difficult. But what do you get out of it? What do they get out of it?
Well, some of them feel they're smiling. They feel relaxed. like, wow, that was great. That felt really good. Other people just feel like, you know, why are you torturing me? You know, this is the professor abusing his students. You know, like I was in some kind of school beating them with a baton or something.
We're talking to Antonio Lopez about his book, The Media Ecosystem, What Ecology Can Teach Us About Responsible Media Practice. And a few minutes ago, you called it a manifesto, or one of a series of manifestos, in which, when you think of manifesto, you think, this is the way it should be done. So what are some of your ideas for how to make the world a better place in terms of the media?
Well, the opening section of the book was supposed to, is written in the tone and style of a manifesto, and it's a little bit different than the rest of the book. And I was a little bit worried that people might get actually turned off, because the rest of the book is a little bit more subtle, and I sort of build my arguments more. But the beginning of the book, I basically open up talking about the spirit of the earth being colonized by corporations as a general problem. And I think this is what the Occupy movement was trying to address, even though they don't use those terms. But the corporations have colonized the planet. We're trying to decolonize the planet. And part of that process is we need to decolonize the public sphere, or decolonize what I use different terms. One term I like is the cultural commons, which is that we have shared knowledge. This is always very important for the evolution of humanity. I mean, throughout time, we've always shared knowledge. We share recipes, how to hunt, how to gather food. And we don't charge for that usually. But we live in a society now where everything is charged for, and because everything has been privatized.
Except there's so much free information on the internet. You can learn how to do just about anything. I mean, you want to fix a particular gasket in the deep depths of your refrigerator. It's all on there. Someone's made a YouTube about it.
Right, exactly. That's one of the points they make in the book, is that we have this irrepressible desire to share information, which contradicts the economic paradigm of our society. And I think this contradiction is what is coming to a head, where people have this need to share, yet this plays out really in the issue of piracy, right? So there's this... The movie studios are trying to create laws that are very draconian, that would imprison people, fine them, get their access denied if they download a few movies, yet the culture is one that shares stuff. So how do you reverse that? You can't. As I said, the genie's out of the bottle. And so the natural practice of humans, the desire to share, is superseding the prerogative of the corporate structure, and that we're coming into conflict with that. So I think Occupy is a strategy to reoccupy public space. And so I talk about that at the very beginning, is that this essentially is what we have to do, is occupy the media or occupy the cultural commons, and to reestablish these spaces, and to promote these little islands at this point, and take advantage of the current technologies like the internet, which enable us to connect more and more. Yet at the same time, corporations like Facebook and Google and Amazon are dividing up the internet. So we're in a very critical place, and I talk about this at the end of the book. We have different scenarios that we're entering into. One scenario is a completely balkanized, privatized internet, which is partially in existence now, or one where we have a really open, truly open internet, and this is a huge struggle. Luckily, we've won a few battles recently. ACTA, which was a internationally negotiated trade agreement, which negotiated in secret, led by the U.S., was going to be a very draconian effort to control piracy, intellectual property, etc. In Europe, they just rejected it across the board, which is fantastic. And that was a victory because the activists took control of the situation. They formed this democracy in action. It seems to be rare these days, but it happened. The internet protests that happened earlier this year, you know, there was these internet laws that the Congress was trying to pass that were written by the entertainment companies that would revoke privileges. There was a big activist movement. Wikipedia famously blacked out their page.
Yeah, that's right. That was a great day.
Yeah, and they stopped these laws. So these are examples of what I call cultural citizenship. So we have to change our role from consumerism to cultural citizenship. And we're encouraged to be consumers in education through the media system. And so it's a real strong political act to be a cultural citizen and to actually engage in these policy changes, support laws, change our buying habits where we can, when we can, and also change our social habits through how we use media.
When you talk about the transition from consumer to citizen, you also have to think about the fact that there was, at some point, and it happened in the early 20th century, a transition from citizen to consumer.
Right.
The creation of the PR industry, the creation of advertising that basically played on people's unconscious desires rather than just advertising, this product is available, and if you would like it, here it is. It was basically, you will feel better about yourself, and you will be more attractive if you use this product, and so on. And on that kind of transition, which basically made for a huge mass market and continual growth of the mass market for consumer products, you have a society that's based on consumerism and whose economy is based on consumerism. And I think one of the big elephants in the middle of the living room, or whatever that is called, is that when you, like, let's say that we all just started shopping at farmers markets and we only consumed local media and we spent our leisure time with each other and we reduced our consumption habits a whole lot, this economy wouldn't stand up as what it is, and nobody's really got an alternative. And we also would be deprived of some of the actual consumer products that have made our lives just infinitely more comfortable.
Yeah, so, true enough. And I think what ultimately, I'll go to what ecological economists argue for, is we don't have to abandon globalization per se, but the growth model based on corporatism is really the problem. So, for example, corporations have to turn a profit every quarter. They're not designed for long-term planning, you know, the short-term profit. So even if you're the most conscientious person working in a large corporation, you love your children, you care about the environment, you donate money to Sierra Club, et cetera, the system is set up for you to maximize profit for your shareholders.
To make PlayStations.
Yeah, to make PlayStations. So their method of accounting has to change. And there are certainly models for that have been developed by ecological economists. Growth is the problem, in my opinion, that's driving climate change. We just simply cannot grow. But it's a religion in our country. You're not allowed to challenge the idea of growth. And if you do, it's like you could be, might as well be a Satanist. You know, like how could you? It's just sacrilegious to talk about that growth has a negative impact on our. On our lifestyle, on our quality of life. And statistics actually show that the more money people make, actually, it doesn't necessarily lead to more happiness.
Well, it does up to a point, and I believe that point is somewhere between $70,000 and $80,000 a year.
Yeah, it's somewhere around there, and you know, I'm sure all of us would be happy to make that much and be quite contented. And I think there's actually enough resources in the world that to sustainably live comfortably. It's just that our system's not designed for that. So how do we transition to an alternative? Well, we're coming up against so many crises that are, to me, interrelated. For example, in Europe, we have the problem of the euro, and we're in a huge economic crisis that still every time they think they fix it, then another it sort of pops up somewhere else. The banking system in Spain is now a big problem. There's not any original thinking. They're going back to the conventional wisdom, which is, at this point, neoliberalism, which I talk about in this book. Neoliberalism is the free market credo, you know, that basically believes that everything should be privatized and financialized. And until we challenge that credo and move in a different direction, we're going to be in a really bad situation. However, there are some people who believe that at a certain point, the dam of denial will break. It could be 5 years, it could be 3 years.
Or the whole system will just fail, whether we're in denial or not. I mean, when enough things fail and they can't be fixed in remedies, it's sort of like when the dam breaks, you don't have a choice about denial.
Exactly. And so how quickly we move to that point remains to be seen. But if you read Bill McKibben's article in the Rolling Stone that just came out talking about climate change, you know, we're basically already in the the threshold of a tipping point of point of no return.
You said a moment ago you were working with people who were eco-economists. Is that the word you used?
Well, yeah, ecological economists.
Ecological economists. Yeah. And one thing that I've been thinking about, and I'm not sure who's working on this, but maybe you can help us, is it seems like there's tremendous room for biomimicry in economics. So if you envision a forest and you have a tree, and the tree reaches a height and it doesn't stop, it doesn't keep growing. It reaches a height and stops. And when you have a healthy ecosystem, some things are growing quickly, and then they all reach a height and stop, and then they decay and die. And it seems like that could be a really good model for an economy.
Well, an example of that could be local currency. So many people argue that, and I certainly see this as a problem in Europe, the euro is, I live in Italy, and it's dominated by the euro. Well, our economy is not the same as Germany's economy or Northern Europe's economy. So the euro inflates everything for us. And so we should not be on the euro. We should be on a currency that's adjusted to our local economy.
Go back to the lira?
Well, see, this is the problem. It's like most people think that it's actually impossible to go back. We're kind of stuck in the situation. But what I'm trying to say is that if we had the option of having local control, we would be better able to deal with the crisis. So what may end up happening is that in parallel to the euro, something along the lines of what happened in Argentina when their economy collapsed is that people started bartering and alternative currencies started to arise.
But you can't barter for computers and for all these other things.
You can't barter for everything, but you could certainly barter services.
But it doesn't speak to the whole issue, which is these things that have made our lives happier and more comfortable and that we want and that are not producible on a local scale.
True enough. Now, there are also examples on the internet of alternative currencies that people are using, like even in virtual reality games. There's actually examples of alternative currencies that people use, and if people accept those alternative currencies, that they'll spend these kind of dollars as opposed to other kind of dollars, that could be one possible solution. I don't have the big catch-all solution to everything.
I don't think anybody does.
No one does. But it's important to create the space where solutions can arise.
Yeah.
And when you have a dominated space where everyone who thinks like the old system, and they're the ones in charge of solving the problem. This is like Einstein said, you can't solve problems with the thinking that created those problems. It's going to be difficult to do that. So one of the points I make in the book is I don't necessarily actually have the answer to a truly ecological media, but at least we could create an open system of media where the solution has a better possibility of arising.
Antonio Lopez is a media literacy expert who teaches media literacy in Rome. He wrote for The New Mexican when he lived here in Santa Fe, and he's the author of the new book, The Media Ecosystem, What Ecology Can Teach Us About Responsible Media Practice. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.